She floated silently and thoughtlessly, like an undreaming embryo in its placental sac, until 7 o'clock in the morning. Then the Big Ben beside the bed tore her out of sleep with its ruthless howl. Rosie sat bolt upright, flailing at the air with hands like claws, and crying out something she didn't understand, words from a dream that was already forgotten. "Don't make me look at you! Don't make me look at you! Don't make me! Don't make me!" Then she saw the cream-colored walls, and a sofa that was really just a love seat with delusions of grandeur, and the light flooding in through the window, and used these things to lock in the reality she needed. Whoever she might have been, or wherever she might have gone in her dreams, she was now Rosie McClendon, a single woman who recorded audiobooks for a living. She had stayed for a long time with a bad man, but had left him and met a good one. She lived in a room at 897 Trenton Street, second floor, end of the hall, good view of Bryant Park. Oh, and one other thing. She was a single woman who never intended to eat another foot-long hot dog in her life, especially one smothered in sauerkraut. They did not agree with her, it seemed. She couldn't remember what she had dreamed. Remember what you have to remember and forget what you need to forget. But she knew how it had started. With her walking into that damned painting, like Alice going through the looking glass. Rosie sat where she was for a moment, wrapping herself in her rosy real world as firmly as she could, then reached out for the relentless alarm clock. Instead of gripping it, she knocked it onto the floor. It lay there, bawling its excited, senseless cry. "Hire the handicapped. It's fun to watch 'em," she croaked. She leaned over and groped for the clock, fascinated all over again by the blonde hair she saw from the corner of her eye, locks so fabulously unlike those of that obedient little creep mouse, Rose Daniels. She got hold of the clock, felt with her thumb for the stud that shut off the alarm, and then paused as something else registered. The breast pressing against her right forearm was naked. She silenced the alarm, then sat up with the clock still in her left hand. She pushed down the sheet and light blanket. Her bottom half was as bare as her top half. "Where's my nightie?" she asked the empty room. She thought she had never heard herself sounding so exceptionally stupid, but of course she wasn't used to going to bed with her nightgown on and waking up naked. Even 14 years of marriage to Norman had not prepared her for anything quite that peculiar. She put the clock back on the night table, swung her legs out of bed. "Ow!" she cried, both startled and frightened by the pain and stiffness in her hips and thighs. Even her butt hurt. "Ow, ow, ow!" She sat on the edge of the bed and gingerly flexed her right leg, then her left. They moved, but they hurt, especially the right one. It was as if she'd spent most of yesterday doing the granddaddy of all workouts, rowing machine, treadmill, stairmaster, although the only exercise she had taken was her walk with Bill, and that had been no more than a leisurely stroll. The sound was like the trains in Grand Central Station, she thought. What sound? For a moment, she thought she almost had it, had something, anyway, and then it was gone again. She got slowly and cautiously to her feet, stood beside the bed for a moment, then walked toward the bathroom, limped toward the bathroom. Her right leg felt as if she had actually strained it somehow, and her kidneys ached. What in God's name? She remembered reading somewhere that people sometimes ran in their sleep. Perhaps that was what she had been doing. Perhaps the jumble of dreams she couldn't quite remember had been so horrible that she'd actually made an effort to run away from them. She stopped in the bathroom doorway and looked back at her bed. The ground sheet was rumpled, but not twisted or tangled or pulled loose, as she would have expected if she had been really active in her sleep. Rosie saw one thing she didn't like much, however, something that flashed her back to the bad old days with terrible and unexpected suddenness. Blood. They were the prints of thin lines rather than drops, however, and they were too far down to have come from a punched nose or a split lip. Unless, of course, her sleeping movements had been so vigorous she'd actually turned around in her bed. Her next thought was that she'd had a visit from the cardinal. This was how her mother had insisted Rosie speak of her menstrual periods, if she had to speak of them at all. But it was entirely the wrong time of the month for that.
Is it your time, girl? Is the moon full for you?
What? She asked the empty room. What about the moon? Again, something wavered, almost held, and then floated away before she could grasp it. She looked down at herself, and one mystery was solved at least. She had a scratch on her upper right thigh, quite a nasty one from the look. That was undoubtedly where the blood on the sheet had come from. Did I scratch myself in my sleep? Is that what... This time, the thought which came into her mind held a little longer, perhaps because it wasn't a thought at all, but an image. She saw a naked woman, herself, edging carefully sideways along a path which was overgrown with thorn bushes. As she turned on the shower and held one hand under the spray to test the temperature, she found herself wondering if you could bleed spontaneously in a dream, if the dream was vivid enough, sort of like those people who bled from their hands and feet on Good Friday.
Stigmata? Are you saying that on top of everything else you're suffering stigmata?
I'm not saying anything because I don't know anything, she answered herself, and how true that was. She supposed she could believe, just about barely, that a scratch might appear spontaneously on a sleeping person's skin, matching a scratch that was occurring at that same moment in the person's dream. It was a stretch, but not entirely out of the question. What was out of the question was the idea that a sleeping person could make the nightgown disappear right off her body simply by dreaming she was naked.
Take off that thing you're wearing.
I can't do that. I don't have anything on underneath.
I won't tell if you won't.
Phantom voices. One she recognized as her own, but the other. It didn't matter. Surely it didn't. She had taken her nightgown off in her sleep, that was all, or perhaps in a brief waking interlude, which she now remembered no better than her weird dreams about running around in the dark or using white stepping stones to cross streams of black water. She had taken it off, and when she got around to looking, she would no doubt find it wadded up under the bed. Right, unless I ate it or something. She pulled back the hand which had been testing the water and looked at it curiously. There were fading reddish-purple stains on the tips of her fingers and a slightly brighter residue of the same stuff under her nails. She raised the hand slowly to her face, and a voice deep down in her mind, not the voice of Practical Sensible this time, at least she didn't think so, responded with unmistakable alarm.
Dasn't put that hand that touches the seeds into your mouth. Dasn't. Dasn't.
What seeds? Rosie asked, frightened. She smelled her fingers and caught just a ghost of an aroma, a smell that reminded her of baking and sweet-cooked sugar. What seeds? What happened last night? Is it...
She made herself stop there. She knew what she had been about to say, but didn't want to hear the question actually articulated, hanging in the air like unfinished business.
Is it still happening?
She got into the shower, adjusted the water until it was as hot as she could take it, and then grabbed the soap. She washed her hands with particular care, scrubbed them until she could not see so much as a trace of that rose madder stain, even under her nails. Then she washed her hair, beginning to vocalize as she did so. Kurt had suggested nursery rhymes in different keys and vocal registers, and that was what she did, keeping her voice low so as not to disturb the people above or below her. When she got out 5 minutes later and dried off, her body was starting to feel a little more like real flesh and a little less like something constructed out of barbed wire and broken glass. Her voice had almost returned to normal as well. She started to put on jeans and a t-shirt, remembered that Rob Lefferts was taking her to lunch, and put on a new skirt instead. Then she sat down in front of the mirror to plait her hair. It was slow going because her back, shoulders, and upper arms were also stiff. Hot water had improved the situation, but not entirely cured it. Yes, it was a good-sized baby for its age, she thought, so absorbed in getting the plait just right that what she was thinking did not even really register. But as she was finishing, she looked into the mirror which reflected the room behind her and saw something which widened her eyes. The morning's other, more minor discordancies slipped from her mind in an instant. "Oh, my God," Rosie said in a strengthless little voice. She got up and walked across the room on legs which felt as nerveless as stilts. In most regards, the picture was just the same. The blonde woman still stood on top of the hill with her plaited hair hanging down between her shoulder blades and her left arm raised. But now the hand shading her eyes made sense, because the thunderheads which had overhung the scene were gone. The sky above the woman in the short gown was the faded blue denim of a humid day in July. A few dark birds which hadn't been there before circled in that sky, but Rosie hardly noticed them. "The sky's blue because the storm is over," she thought. "It ended while I was, well, while I was somewhere else." All she could remember for sure about that somewhere else was that it had been dark and scary. That was enough. She didn't want to remember any more, and she thought maybe she didn't want to have her picture reframed after all. She knew she had changed her mind about showing it to Bill tomorrow, or even mentioning it. It would be bad if he saw the change from overcast and thunderheads to hazy sunshine, yes, but it would be even worse if he saw no change at all. That would mean she was losing her mind. "I'm not sure I want the damn thing anymore at all," she thought. "It's scary. Do you want to hear something really hilarious? I think it might be haunted." She picked the unframed canvas up, holding the edges with her palms, denying her conscious mind access to the thought, "Careful, Rosie, don't fall in," that caused her to handle it that way. There was a tiny closet to the right of the door leading out into the hall, with nothing in it yet but the low-top sneakers she'd been wearing when she left Norman, and a new sweater made out of some cheap synthetic stuff. She had to put the picture down in order to open the door. She could have tucked it under her arm long enough to free one hand, of course, but somehow didn't like to do that. And when she picked it up again, she paused, looking fixedly at it. The sun was out, definitely new, and there were big black birds circling in the sky above the temple. Probably new, but wasn't there something else as well? Some other change? She thought so, and she thought she wasn't seeing it because it wasn't an addition, but a deletion. Something was gone, something... "I don't want to know," Rosie told herself brusquely. "I don't even want to think about it, so there." Yes, so there. But she was sorry to feel the way she did, because she'd begun by thinking of the picture as her personal good luck charm, a kind of rabbit's foot. And of one thing there was absolutely no doubt. It was thinking of Rose Madder, standing there so fearlessly on top of her hill, that had pulled her through on her first day in the recording studio when she'd suffered the panic attack. So she didn't want to be having these unpleasant feelings about the picture, and most assuredly didn't want to be afraid of it. But she was. After all, the weather in oil paintings usually didn't clear up overnight, and the amount of stuff you could see in them usually didn't grow and contract, as if some unseen projectionist were switching back and forth between lenses. She didn't know what she was going to do with the picture in the long run, but she knew where it was going to spend today and the coming weekend, in the closet, keeping her old sneaks company. She put it in there, propped it against the wall, resisting an urge to turn it around so it would also face the wall, and then closed the door. With that done, she slipped into her only good blouse, took her purse, and left the room. As she walked down the long, dingy corridor leading to the stairs, two words whispered up from the very bottom of her mind. "I repay." She stopped at the head of the stairs, shivering so violently she almost dropped her purse, and for a moment her right leg ached almost all the way up to her buttock, as if she had been struck with a savage cramp. Then it passed, and she went quickly down to the first floor. "I won't think about it," she told herself as she walked down the street to the bus stop. "I don't have to if I don't want to, and I most definitely don't want to. I'll think about Bill instead. Bill and his motorcycle. Thinking about Bill got her to work and into the dark-toned world of Kill All My Tomorrows without a hitch. And at lunch, there was even less time to think of the woman in the painting. Mr. Lefferts took her to a tiny Italian place called Della Famina, the nicest restaurant Rosie had ever been in. And while she was eating her melon, he offered her what he called a more solid business arrangement. He proposed signing her to a contract which would pay her $800 a week for 20 weeks or 12 books, whichever came first. It wasn't the $1,000 a week Rhoda had urged her to hold out for, but Robbie also promised to put her together with an agent who would set her up with as many radio spots as she wanted. "You can make $22,000 by the end of the year, Rose. More, if you want it. But why knock yourself out?" She asked him if she could have the weekend to think about it. Mr. Lefferts told her she certainly could. Before he left her in the lobby of the Corn Building, Rhoda and Kurt were sitting on a bench by the elevator, gossiping like a couple of thieves. He held his hand out to her. She returned the gesture, expecting her hand to be shaken. Instead, he took it in both of his, bowed, and kissed it. The gesture, no one had ever kissed her hand before, although she had seen it done in lots of movies, sent a shiver up her back. It was only as she sat in the recording booth watching Kurt thread up a fresh reel in the other room that her thoughts returned to the picture which was now safely, you hope, Rosie, you hope, stashed away in her closet. Suddenly she knew what the other change had been, what had been subtracted from the picture. The armlet. The woman in the rose-madder chiton had been wearing it above her right elbow. This morning, her arm had been bare all the way to her shapely shoulder. When she got back to her room that night, Rosie dropped to her knees and peered beneath her unmade bed. The gold armlet lay all the way in the back, standing on edge in the dark and gleaming softly. To Rosie, it looked like the wedding ring of a giantess. Something else lay beside it, a small folded square of blue cloth. She found a piece of her missing nightgown after all, it seemed. There were reddish-purple spatters on it. These looked like blood, but Rosie knew they weren't. They were the spill of fruits better not tasted. She had scrubbed similar stains off her fingers this morning in the shower. The armlet was extremely heavy, a pound at least, perhaps even two. If it was made of the stuff it looked like it was made of, how much might it be worth? $12,000? $15,000? Not bad, considering it had somehow come out of a painting she'd gotten by trading away a nearly worthless engagement ring. Still, she didn't like to touch it, and she put it on the night table beside the lamp. She held the little packet of blue cotton in her hand for a moment, sitting there like a teenager with her back propped against the bed and her feet crossed, and then she unfolded one side. She saw three seeds. Three little seeds. And as Rosie looked at them with hopeless and unreasoning horror, those merciless words recurred, clanging in her head like iron bells. I repay. Picnickers.
Norman had been trolling for her. He lay awake late in his hotel room on Thursday night and across midnight's dark knife edge into Friday morning. He turned off all the lights except for the fluorescent bar over the bathroom sink. It threw a diffuse glow across the room that he liked. It made him think of the way streetlights looked when you saw them through a heavy mist. He lay almost exactly as Rosie had lain before falling asleep on that same Thursday night, only with just one hand under his pillow instead of both. He needed the other to smoke with and to convey the bottle of Glenlivet standing on the floor to his lips. "Where are you, Rosie?" he asked the wife, who was no longer there. "Where are you, and where did you ever find the nerve to cut and run, a scared little creep mouse like you?" It was this second question he cared about the most, how she had dared. The first one didn't matter all that much, not in any practical sense, because he knew where she was going to be on Saturday, A lion doesn't have to bother himself about where the zebra feeds. All he has to do is wait by the waterhole where it drinks. So far, so good, but still, how had she ever dared leave him in the first place? Even if there was no life for him beyond their final conversation, he wanted to know that. Had it been planned? An accident? An aberration born of a single impulse? Had anyone helped her? Besides, that was the late Peter Slowick in the cavalcade of cunts on Durham Avenue. What had she been doing since she'd hit the bricks of this charming little city by the lake? Waitressing? Shaking farts out of sheets in some flea bag like this? He didn't think so. She was too lazy to do menial work. You only had to look at the way she kept house to see that, and she had no skills to do anything else. If you wore tits, that left just one other choice. She was out there someplace right now, selling it on some street corner. Of course she was. What else? God knew she was a lousy lay. Screwing her had been about as exciting as fucking mud, but pussy was something men would pay for, even if it didn't do anything but lie there and drool a little after the rodeo was over. So yes, sure, she was probably out there selling it. He'd ask her about it, though. He would ask her everything. And when he had all the answers he needed, all the answers he ever wanted from the likes of her, he would wrap his belt around her neck so she couldn't scream, and then he would bite and bite and bite. His mouth and jaw still ached from what he had done to Thumper, the amazing urban Jew boy, but he wouldn't let that stop him or even slow him down. He had 3 Percodans at the bottom of his traveling bag, and he would take them before he went to work on his lost lamb, his sweet little rambling rose. As for afterward, after it was over, after the perks wore off. But he couldn't see that, and he didn't want to see that. He had an idea that there was going to be no after, only darkness, and that was all right. In fact, a long dose of darkness might be just what the doctor ordered. He lay in bed and drank the best scotch in the world and burned one cigarette after another, watching the smoke drift up to the ceiling in silky wreaths that turned blue when they passed through the soft white radiance from the bathroom. And he trolled for her. He trolled for her, and his hook slipped through nothing but water. There was nothing there, and it was driving him crazy. It was as if she had been abducted by aliens or something. At one point, quite drunk by then, he had dropped a live cigarette into his hand and clenched his fist around it, imagining it was her hand instead of his, that he was holding his hands over hers, clamping hers tight on the heat. And as the pain bit in and wisps of smoke curled out around his knuckles, he whispered, "Where are you, Rose? Where are you hiding, you thief?" Not long after that, he drifted off. He woke up around 10 on Friday morning, unrested and hungover and vaguely frightened. He had dreamed peculiar dreams all night long. In them, he was still awake and still lying in his bed here on the 9th floor of the Whitestone, and the light from the bathroom was still cutting softly through the darkness of his room, and the cigarette smoke was still rising through it in shifting blue membranes. Only in his dreams, he could see pictures like movies in the smoke. He could see Rose in the smoke. "There you are," he thought, as he watched her walk through a dead garden in a pelting rainstorm. Rose was naked for some reason, and he felt an unexpected bite of lust. He hadn't felt anything at the sight of her nakedness but weary revulsion for 8 years or more, but now she looked different. Pretty good, in fact. "It isn't that she's lost weight," he thought in the dream, "although it looks like she has, a little, anyway. Mostly it's something about the way she's moving, what she's got. What is it?" Then it came to him. She had the look of a woman who's fucking someone and hasn't had anywhere near enough just yet. If it had even crossed his mind to doubt this assessment, to say, "What, Rosie? You've got to be kidding, cousin." One look at her hair would have been enough to settle the question once and for all. She dyed it slut blonde as if she thought she was Sharon Stone or maybe Madonna. He watched the smoke rose leave the weird dead garden and approach a stream so dark it looked more like ink than water. She crossed it on a path of stepping stones, holding her arms out for balance, and he saw that she had some sort of wet, crumpled rag in one hand. It looked like a nightgown to Norman, and he thought, "Why don't you put it on, you brazen bitch? Or are you expecting your boyfriend to come by and give your ticket a punch? I'd like to see that, I really would. Tell you one thing, if I so much as catch you holding hands with a guy when I finally track you down, the cops are gonna find his goddamn trouser rat sticking out of his asshole like a birthday candle. No one came by, though. Not in the dream, anyway. The rose over his bed, the smoke rose, walked down a path through a grove of trees that looked as dead as, well, as dead as Peter Slowick. At last, she came into a clearing where there was one tree which still looked alive. She knelt down, picked up a bunch of seeds, and wrapped them in what looked like another piece of her nightgown. With that done, she got up, went to a set of stairs near the tree, in dreams you never knew what fucked up thing was going to happen next, and disappeared down them. He was waiting around for her to come back up when he began to feel a presence behind him, something as cold and chill as a draft from an open meat locker. He'd handled some fairly scary people during his years as a cop. The PCP addicts he and Harley Bissington had had to deal with from time to time were probably the scariest. And you developed a sense of their presence after a while. Norman was feeling that now. Someone was coming up behind him, and he never doubted for a moment that it was someone dangerous. "I repay," a woman's voice whispered. It was a sweet voice, and soft, but it was terrifying just the same. There was no sanity in it. "Good for you, bitch," Norman said in his dream. "You try to repay me, and I'll change your whole fucking outlook." She screamed, a sound that seemed to go directly to the center of his head without even passing through his ears, and he sensed her lunging toward him with her hands out. He drew in a deep breath and blew the cigarette smoke apart. The woman disappeared. Norman felt her go. For a little while after that, there was only darkness, with him floating peacefully in the middle of it, untouched by the fears and desires which haunted him when he was awake. He woke up at 10 past 10 on Friday morning and shifted his eyes from the clock by the bed to the hotel room ceiling, almost expecting to see phantom figures moving through decaying stacks of cigarette smoke. There were no figures, of course, phantom or otherwise, no smoke for that matter, just the lingering smell of Pall Malls, in hoc signo vinces. There was only Detective Norman Daniels, lying here in a sweaty bed that smelled of tobacco and used booze. His mouth tasted as if he had spent the previous evening sucking the end of a freshly polished Cordovan shoe, and his left hand hurt like a mad bastard. He opened it and saw a shiny blister in the center of his palm. He looked at it for a long time, while pigeons fluttered and cooed at each other on the shit-encrusted ledge that ran past his window. At last, the memory of blistering himself with the cigarette came back, and he nodded. He'd done it because he couldn't see Rose no matter how hard he tried, and then, as if in compensation, he'd had crazy dreams about her all night long. He placed two fingers on the side of the blister and squeezed, slowly increasing the pressure until it popped. He wiped his hand on the sheet, relishing the waves of stinging pain. He lay looking at his hand, watching it throb almost, for a minute or so. Then he reached under his bed for his traveling bag. There was a Sucrets tin at the bottom, and in it were a dozen or so assorted pills. A few were speedy, but most were downers. As a general rule, Norman found he could get up with no pharmacological help at all. It was getting back down again that sometimes presented a problem. He took a Percodan with a small swallow of scotch, then lay back, looking up at the ceiling and once again smoking one cigarette after another, stubbing them out in the overflowing ashtray when they were done. This time it wasn't Rose he was thinking of, at least not directly. This time it was the picnic he was considering, the one being thrown by her new friends. He had been to Edinger's Pier, and what he saw there wasn't encouraging. It was large, a combination beach, picnic area, and amusement park, and he didn't see any way he could stake it out with any confidence of seeing her arrive and leave. If he'd had 6 men, even 4 if they knew what they were doing, he would have felt differently, but he was on his own. There were 3 ways in, assuming she didn't come by boat, and he could hardly watch all 3 of them at the same time. That meant working the crowd, and working the crowd would be a bitch kitty.